Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Drew Deitch. Today we're talking all about the 1983 film, The Dead Zone. This is one of those ones that happened to come out fairly quickly after the book's release. You know, we had some time to spend with the book, though. So it wasn't as quick as Christine, which came out the same year as the book, but it is definitely one that you get this idea of what it would look like in your head, and then you get someone like David Cronenberg directing it, and you're like, okay, you know, I think this is going to match up fairly well. And Drew, I know you have a lot of the 80s stuff that you want to talk about. So what about The Dead Zone made you want to hop on this episode for it?
There's so many things, because so much. I love this movie, and I actually, this is one of the novels that I have read, and I read it after I'd seen the movie, and I loved reading up about King's impetus to write the story, which it's really comes down to he wanted to write a story where you could make a political assassin the, if not the hero of the story, at least totally understandable and sympathetic. And his way of getting to that idea ends up, you know, being this story about somebody who can have psychic visions. And so already that premise alone is very interesting. But when you talk about the movie itself, this is kind of ground zero for David Cronenberg fans in regards to him really hitting the mainstream in film, because earlier in this year that The Dead Zone came out in February of 83, he had Videodrome come out, which was his kind of biggest critical and commercial success at that point. And then just a few months later, he has The Dead Zone come out. And this is a movie that I think really hit with critics and audiences and kind of solidified him as this very important, very smart genre director. And The Dead Zone is kind of the perfect story for him to explore some of his ideas about humanity. Because at the end of the day, The Dead Zone is kind of a story about humanity and what kind of our empathy and our ability to empathize and sympathize with others.
I will admit I have not seen Videodrome, but I'm also really bad at watching things that I probably should have. I think I'll have to add that to my list, because just seeing what he was able to do with The Dead Zone, it's like, okay, you know, this is someone whose filmography I might want to dive into. You know, The Dead Zone isn't the only thing of his that I've seen, but I feel like when you have a director this well known, and we'll be talking about the cast too, because there are some really big names in this, but you really want them to succeed too, regardless of whether or not they end up being a genre director, so to speak. You know, some will stick with sort of similar stories. You know, I know Mike Flanagan, for instance, he's mm-hmm. going to be working on Dr. Sleep, but he's done The Haunting of Hill House, Hush. He's sort of sticking with the horror genre, but I think certain directors have this ability to see so many different types of stories from so many different angles that it makes it very interesting.
Cronenberg is fascinating because he's got a reputation for being the body horror director. Like, a lot of his early movies have to do with something about our bodies betraying us in some way. And much like an earlier film of his, Scanners, The Dead Zone takes another approach to our body, but probably the most complicated part of our body, which is our mind. What if our mind actually began to betray us in a way? And in The Dead Zone, that's through the lead character, Johnny Smith, you know, getting in this accident and uncovering this latent ability that he has of psychic premonition. And what I like about in the story as it goes on is, because this is kind of an idea that I feel, you know, 35 plus years later, we've kind of seen played out in so many other different stories that it right. seems old hat. But if you go back to The Dead Zone, which is one of the real kind of, like I said, mainstreamification of this idea. It's not a happy one. It is a really tragic story.
Absolutely. And I think between having Cronenberg on this and some of the cast members, you know, you have Christopher Walken as Johnny Smith, and later on you have Martin Sheen as Greg Stilson. And I think just the combination of the director and the cast really made this story come together in such a way that you couldn't help but enjoy it, but at the same time kind of also be saddened by it. It's not the most optimistic story ever.
Oh,
and
no, not at all.
Yeah, you have a few things that I would say are minor changes that do make a big difference, though, in the end. And, you know, we'll talk about one of those in particular a little later. But to have those big names, in addition to Tom Skerritt, Herbert Lom, Brooke Adams, even Anthony Zerbe, I want to say. I'm really bad at name pronunciations.
No, you got it.
But just those characters in general, you know, some of them might not be super well known by name, but I was watching it and I was like, you know, some of these guys look familiar here, and it's because they just play these character roles so well. They don't need to be the lead in the movie for them to have an impact.
No, it's a character actor smorgasbord in this movie. And I do have to give particular praise to Christopher Walken, because at this point in our culture, Christopher Walken kind of became known as a caricature of himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of doing a disservice, because he became a notable character actor for a reason. And I really think his performance in The Dead Zone is one of those reasons. He is justifiably haunted and kind of prickly in this movie. And it plays perfectly into Johnny Smith's character, who he doesn't see what's happened to him as a gift. He doesn't see it as something that is really there to make the world better. It's made his world so much worse and is in the end killing him. And Walken plays the entire role kind of with almost like a walking corpse feel.
He always has that sort of pale look to him, too. And I don't think he's ever really been a guy who's been one of those super tan Hollywood actors or anything that.
No, not at all.
And it just fits so well for the role, because when I was reading The Dead Zone and sort of picturing Johnny Smith, you know, he was never this guy who had a summer tan or anything like that. He was sort of this kind of, not necessarily lanky, because I never really paid attention to how tall he would have been in the story or anything like that. But you sort of just think of this skinny figure, especially after being in a coma for so long. You know, people always lose weight when they're in a coma, no matter how long or short it is. But because of the length of his, you sort of just see him as this frail guy who's trying to just get back to normal, which is still pretty skinny for him, you know. And that was depicted so well in this movie. And I think, you know, just the fact that Christopher Walken already had that complexion about him, it's like, okay, this was an excellent choice, even if he had only really been a character actor up until that point.
Well, I love when somebody remarks on, it looks like he's lost weight, and he's like, yeah, they call it coma diet. which he's really funny in the movie, because that's kind of, Johnny uses this kind of self-deprecating humor to disarm people and even himself. But
yeah,
I mean, I love seeing him when we first see him as a teacher, you know, reciting The Raven to the class, and he's got these just, he's just such an adorable dweeb. Like I've seen Christopher Walken in plenty of things, and as soon as he came on and he's got just these just horrible, horrible bangs and his big grandpa glasses, I'm like, I buy him totally as some, you know, rural literature teacher, which is, you know, what Johnny Smith is. I think Walken's great, but I think surrounding him with so many great, solid character actors really, really helps elevate things. I mean, Herbert Lom, who is, you know, I know from a couple like Hammer films and some British horror films of the 60s and 70s. He adds a great gravitas to what could be kind of, I think, a stand-in sort of role, right, as Johnny's doctor. But Herbert Lom imbues it with such importance and almost a sense of regalness that you're like, oh yeah, that's why casting matters.
Absolutely. And in the book, the doctor plays a pretty big role. So to have that still apply, even if we don't really feel like we see him quite as much as he's mentioned in the book, it's one of those things where, okay, you're working with a couple hours versus however many hours it takes you to read The Dead Zone. And
right.
I think what Cronenberg did a nice job of, and especially Jeffrey Baum, who wrote the screenplay, you know, they picked out the right parts to focus on from the book. And, you know, we don't spend too much time with Johnny in a coma. And I think that sort of can lead us right into the story because, you know, in the book, it sort of takes a little more time at the beginning to get to the thick of the story. But in this, it's like, okay, we have a limited time. So we're going to show the accident, show the coma. He's going to be out of it. And then it'll sort of be the physical therapy portion of the story, and it'll just build up from there. And I think they did a very nice job pacing that out because, no offense to coma patients, but not the most exciting for a story.
No, I mean, unfortunately, it's not even that it's exciting. It's just something that's very hard to do cinematically. In a book, when you can be as interior with a character as you want to be for however long you want to be, it's you can do anything with that kind of setup. But
yeah,
I appreciate The Dead Zone as a script and as a film because it's lean. It's really lean.
It is.
There really is not a lot of fat on the story to kind of, you know, like as far as subplots or characters that don't really go anywhere, or more importantly, subplots and characters that don't in some way inform what's going on with Johnny from an emotional standpoint. And I'm not surprised that The Dead Zone eventually ended up becoming a television series, because on the outside, you can look at this story and see how it perfectly adapts itself to something that would be episodic. He's a guy that's got psychic powers that helps solve crimes. Let's do that for 5 seasons.
Yeah.
But what I like about the Dead Zone film, and obviously this is material that's from the book, is that these kind of episodic asides that Johnny has with his gift are all incidents that are informing him towards the eventual climax, towards the decision that he has to make. Because, you know, shortly after he comes out of his coma, he touches one of the nurses and sees that her house is on fire and her daughter is in the house. And that's the first, oh, he's got this gift. And then we get a couple more instances of him using this ability. But then the big one that, you know, takes up a good section of the movie is when Sheriff Bannerman, played by Tom Skerritt, comes and asks him to help with this string of killings that they haven't been able to solve. And
right. And
the moment where they have a new victim and Johnny touches the victim and sees how she was killed, he keeps saying, I saw him kill her. I did nothing. I did nothing. And it's that moment where you're like, oh, this isn't just a, hey, let's go use this psychic to solve crimes kind of pulpy story. It's attacking Johnny's desire to be passive with this ability that he has.
Especially because he has to know in the back of his mind there's nothing he could have possibly done. You know, the victim is already dead by the time he even has any input. And you still see it eating away at him. And I think that tells you a lot about Johnny as a person. And, you know, I think that's partially one thing that differed from the book too, was how much Frank Dodd was in this. Because from what I recall in the book, he wasn't really mentioned by name, let alone really brought up that soon. But we actually end up getting this big scene from Frank Dodd afterwards, because Johnny realizes that, hey, he's the cop and he's the killer. So it's one of those things that sort of just shocks the town, because if a cop is going to do that, you know, how are they going to sort of trust the rest? And they don't really dive into that too much, because then they go into the Greg Stilson storyline. So, you know, it's interesting that they chose to sort of put that at the forefront so much in the first half of the movie.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because this gets brought up to Johnny by Sheriff Bannerman, and Johnny refuses to help. He's like, no, I'm not going to help. And then it's only later that he decides to help. And then it's like, oh, well, maybe if he had helped earlier, this girl wouldn't have died. He could have helped, been more preventative. We don't know, but I think that's how Johnny kind of feels,
right?
And where that kind of leads him towards having to do something about Greg Stilson. But I mean, I have to talk about the Dodd stuff, because if I remember correctly, in the book, it kind of shifts perspective to, we don't know that it's Dodd at the time, but whoever this killer is. And this movie is completely 100% grounded in Johnny's perspective, which I think is the right choice for a movie version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the Dodd section is pretty much like the most horror movie this story kind of really gets.
Absolutely.
And the sequence in which they go to Dodd's house and confront his mother is absolutely chilling. Not only because there is an incredibly violent death, but the moment where Johnny touches Dodd's mother's hand and he says, "You knew." It's like, oh, that's like the horribleness of Johnny's gift. It's not just that he's seeing these things that he could prevent. He's learning incredibly dark things about everybody he touches. Like when the one smarmy reporter asks him to use his gift and Johnny touches him, he says, "You want to know about your sister and why she killed herself?" And we never know what happened, but immediately it's this terrible implication. And again, to reaffirm Johnny's ability as a curse, it's like, it's not just that he can see things he can prevent. It's that he sees the worst in everybody.
Absolutely. He's sort of getting a glimpse at the worst moment in their lives. You know, for the nurse, he was able to prevent that moment from coming true, at least. Mm-hmm. But as he sort of starts to get used to his powers more and more, it's almost as if he doesn't have a filter at that point, especially with that moment you mentioned with the sister killing herself and everything, because, you know, he just sees this and he's so overwhelmed by it that he has to get this out. Otherwise, it's just going to continue eating him up like it did with the victim of Frank Dodd that we see him with. And you just have so many moments in this where you can tell he wants to do the right thing, but he knows it's going to come at a cost for himself.
Yeah, and I like that when he touches Herbert Lom, the secret that he learns is that you know, the doctor was separated from his mother during World War II, and tells him, your mother's alive, like she made it out. And Herbert Lom calls his mom and can't talk to her. And when Johnny asks him about this, the doctor says, "I couldn't say anything to her. It wasn't meant to be." And that is so heartbreaking, not just because of that doctor's story, but because it instills in Johnny this idea of, well, maybe I shouldn't be using my gift, because whatever I'm seeing, I'm potentially changing things, and maybe I'm not supposed to change things. And that's why I think part of the reason he ends up secluding himself. But when he gets involved with the Castle Rock killer, he realizes, no, like, I have to do something. And especially when he learns that what's going on with his gift is pretty much the equivalent of cancer, which is something Cronenberg is very interested in as an idea. And that this thing is going to kill him. So Johnny's like, well, if I'm going to die, I need to make something out of the time I have left with this ability that I have.
Right. What do you think of the storyline between Johnny and Sarah? Because that is one of the ones that ultimately gets us to the Greg Stilson portion of the story. Because in the movie, you have Sarah campaigning for him. And obviously, before she even stops by, you have the big sort of billboard going up outside that Johnny can see. So it's pretty much in his face from the start before he even ever meets the man. And I think because of his relationship with Sarah, he was even more likely to get involved when he knew she was campaigning for him and everything like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mentioned that the movie is pretty grounded from Johnny's perspective, except for one scene which involves Stilson and his intimidation of a newspaper writer.
Yeah.
And from what I remember of the book is a little bit more structured to where the book will take a few chapters to completely show us Greg Stilson pretty much growing up along with Johnny, not as, you know, together, but along, you know, their same timelines. Like, I remember one of the stories is about Greg Stilson, like, kicking a dog to death or something.
Yeah.
And really painting him in the reader's mind very early on as this monster. Whereas Stilson has a presence in the movie. I mean, he's first just mentioned by the reporter at Johnny's press conference, but the real in to Johnny kind of, you know, meeting Stilson. Well, I mean, he meets him a little bit earlier when he's at Anthony Zerbe's house and he's tutoring his son. But when when he goes to search for Sarah at this rally, because they, you know, they were in a relationship before he got into the accident, and then he wakes up, it's 5 years later and she's moved on. She's got a husband, but she still obviously has feelings for him. She shows up at his house and, you know, they sleep together. And, you know, Johnny's like, okay, you know, hey, this is, maybe things are coming back. But Sarah says, like, we can't see each other again. Not this way, you know, not romantically. And Sarah's character is pretty much there to be a reminder to him that your life that you thought you were going to have is never going to happen. And as much as you keep trying to fight for it, every time he gets closer to Sarah, something else happens involving his gift that, you know, calls his attention. And the ultimate one at the end being when he's trying, you know, I'm going to hunt her down at this rally. Like, I have to see her. I have to say something to her. That's when he ends up touching Greg Stilson's hand and seeing that this guy's going to become the president and he's going to end up being the one that initiates nuclear Armageddon.
It's interesting how he's able to see different periods of time as well. And maybe that's because you're sort of seeing the worst decisions or moments in these people's lives. But, you know, mm-hmm. with the nurse, that's something that needs to be handled immediately. You know, the house is on fire literally right now. And you actually get a pretty cool moment with that scene in particular, too, where he's in the hospital, but he's also in the house with the girl. And I thought that was really well done. And, you know, we can dive into the cinematography and visuals a little more once we get through the story. But I just had to make sure I didn't forget about that moment. So
no, I have that noted here, too, because it's definitely something I want to bring up. But yeah, you know, the story, he has a moment with I love the way this is actually revealed is Johnny starts tutoring Anthony Zerbe's son, and the son is seen as, you know, kind of reclusive, and, you know, he's not into sports. He's what we would call an indoor kid nowadays. And Anthony Zerbe wants Johnny to tutor him, and during the course of this, Johnny has a vision of the kid and his friend going out and playing hockey on a lake and sinking to the bottom and drowning. And he warns them. He's, you know, saying the ice is going to break. You can't go. And the movie does a really fun thing where it tells us, okay, we're going to call it off. We're not going to go. Johnny thinks everything's okay. Then comes back in. Anthony Zerbe's like, come on, get your stuff. We're going to go to this hockey game. And the kid's like, I thought you called it off. Then Johnny sees in the newspaper that the accident happened and kids drowned. And he thinks, oh my God, you know, this kid that I was getting close to drowned. And we see him calling Anthony Zerbe, and the camera focuses on Anthony Zerbe sitting in his living room, looking despondent. We're like, and the phone just keeps ringing and ringing and ringing. We're like, oh, his kid died, only for it to finally dolly back far enough. And the kid's in the frame. And I went, oh, that's right. He's alive.
Like, yeah.
It's so clever. And that's why you need somebody like Cronenberg doing this, because it'd be really easy for that moment to be kind of just flat, you know, delivering the information of the scene. But that actually makes it a tiny little emotional roller coaster. But yeah, then the story goes on and we have, you know, the main climactic thrust of the story, which is Greg Stilson's character, who is just this absolute villain of a politician.
Right.
And who we see is going to end up pretty much destroying the world. And you know, props to Martin Sheen. You know, I have to say, if you want to get somebody that is just so, you know, just it's
easy
amazing.
To hate.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how good Martin Sheen is at being just completely inhuman. I mean, he really is. It's a character that you kind of have to make into nothing but a monster to justify what you want Johnny to do in the end. Because if we saw anything that at all humanized Stilson, it would make Johnny's decision at the end to assassinate him a lot more morally complex and maybe difficult in a good way. But that wasn't really kind of the story I think King wanted to tell with this. He wanted to say, like, I mean, he poses directly the question, you know, kind of the thought experiment that's as old as time between Johnny and the doctor, where Johnny asks him, if you could kill Hitler before he rose to power, would you do it? And I love the doctor's response, where he's like, well, I'm a doctor and I have taken an oath to care for people and I love people and I want to do everything I can to help them. And with all that said, I'd still kill the son of a bitch. And it's like, wow. It's dark, but you totally understand that motivation.
Exactly. I think with Martin Sheen too, it's just one of those things where you think the actor does such a great job to where it's so easy to see him as this dislikable character. And that's a testament to just how well this was cast. And I think, you know, if you have someone else in the role, it may not have been delivered quite as well as it was.
Yeah, it could have come off as cartoony. And I don't think Sheen quite takes it there. He's still overly despicable, but he doesn't get to the point of, you know, twirling his mustache, so to speak.
He's just so smug with himself the entire time that it sort of tiptoes that line very well. And that brings us to Johnny thinking he has to stop this guy no matter what. And he sets up at one of the rallies, which is, I don't know where it is, but it's, you know, not too far from him. He gets there. He has this rifle that he basically stole from his dad's place.
Yeah.
And he is very, not necessarily brazen about it, but he's very calculated about what he's going to do. He's like, okay, he's going to be standing here. I'll take the higher ground and, you know, no one should be sitting up there because everyone will want to be down closer to him. Mm-hmm. So he sort of just hides behind the decorations that are set up and everything. And no one notices that he's there until he takes the shot. And this gives us also the most despicable moment for Greg Stilson, because he takes Sarah's kid and uses him as a shield. And it's funny because I remember watching the extra features and everything on this one, and it's Martin Sheen's son, who isn't an actor, who is the one taking the pictures at the rally.
Ah, okay.
And so it's ironically his actual son who gets that photo for the front of Time magazine. And I thought that was a nice little tidbit because, you know, the Sheen family is pretty well known for various reasons.
Yes, they have an extensive acting family tree.
Yeah, and to have it be the one who doesn't act, who just gets that shot that buries him, I was like, that's pretty cool. That's a nice little tidbit there.
Yeah, that's a nice little bit of kind of, you know, behind the scenes poetry.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I love this. The entire build up to the assassination attempt, I think, is so well executed with one of the bullets. You know, Johnny drops one of the bullets off the balcony and it slides down. Somebody kicks it underneath a chair. It's very classic kind of movie tension building. And of course, the thing that stops, well, that doesn't stop him, but makes Johnny miss his target is that right at the moment Johnny's about to shoot, Sarah sees him in the wings. And so again, she is this kind of beacon of, you know, I'm going to, of disruption. And what I like about it is I don't read that as like a negative on her character. She, in her own way, is playing a very important part in Johnny's life in relation to his gift. I mean, because even though Johnny does not end up killing Stilson, which as much as we're on board with it happening, it's a murder. Like it's trying to justify murder. And Sarah is the thing that stops him from doing that, but still his intended goal of stopping Stilson from becoming the president, it ends up coming true. And I think, you know, Johnny at the end, when, you know, he is shot and is dying and is able to grab Stilson and sees that, you know, this isn't going to happen, that Stilson's ruined and he ends up committing suicide, Johnny smiles and he's like, you know, I stopped you. Again, it's dark stuff, but incredibly effective.
It's one of those moments where, you know, Johnny has succeeded without having to have the end goal of killing Stilson. And he's able to sort of get that closure, and it just wraps everything up so nicely, even though he's not going to make it out of this because, you know, Stilson is obviously at the ready with a bodyguard and everything like that. And I do want to note that even though at the time the son wasn't really into acting, he did find his way into the acting and producing world eventually. So I don't know, maybe that kicked something off for him.
Sure. Well, but I also like that the movie doesn't linger too long after, you know, Johnny's death. It pretty much ends, which is like, yeah, that's the appropriate ending point of the story. We don't need kind of a denouement with Johnny's funeral or something. This was the point of the story that, you know, Johnny's gift, or rather his curse, got him to this point and helped him do something that seems horrible, but in the end was helping the world. And because of Sarah, he gets right up to the edge and, you know, is willing to do this horrible thing, but she's the one that stops him while still fulfilling his intention of stopping Stilson. And again, I have to praise Christopher Walken's performance in this. You know, I'm bummed that there are people who just know him as kind of an accent to joke about, because I think these final moments as Johnny, they're great. I mean, they made me realize, like, yeah, I cared about this character. As chilly as the movie can feel sometimes, I think this is where you realize it was earning this arc and the emotions that it's wanting to get out of the audience.
I think we can definitely jump into the cinematography now, because we've mentioned a couple of the really, really great shots in this, with the hospital scene and the one you mentioned when we think the kid is dead because we hear about this accident and the look on his father's face, but they pull it back just enough for you to be like, oh, okay, there's a little sense of relief, even though there was still an accident and that's terrible. You know, we hadn't seen those other kids really, so we didn't have this attachment. And I think the cinematography does a nice job of making you feel these things that you wouldn't have felt without these shots being done in that specific way.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to talk about that fire stunt, which is just something that would never happen today, where there is a shot of Christopher Walken in bed with flames on the blanket that he's on and surrounded by fire. And it's an astonishing shot. Like it sells this concept to us of how he experiences these visions, where he literally gets put in the middle of them. And that entire setup where he is, you know, his hand is like right next to an open flame, I was amazed by seeing again. But there's so much. I mean, obviously Cronenberg has gone on to be known as a great director, but there's simple stuff I really love. One of the shots I wrote down is when he originally agrees to help the sheriff out with these murders. They go to the location where one of the bodies was found, and it's this big tunnel that the sheriff says, oh yeah, the kids use this as a shortcut when they're coming from school or whatever. And there is this long, long crane shot of the tunnel that's just lit by a car's headlights at the end of the tunnel. And it is just, it seems so simple, but it was really breathtaking to me in regards to creating a mood of this, like, okay, this is a metaphorical tunnel. This is a path that Johnny is going down now that he's, you know, going to get sucked into, that just looks so beautiful. And that shot lasts for quite a while. It takes its time and kind of establishes a mood and a feeling that you can only really get from a real location. Like whatever that tunnel is that they scouted that location, bravo, because it's one of the images I immediately think of when I think of this movie.
That was certainly an amazing shot, and just the feeling you get when you see it too. It's like this sort of closed in space, you know, even though it's a pretty big tunnel, it almost feels claustrophobic in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it just seems wet and damp and gross, and you're like, all right, yes, it's snowing, but there's still something just creepy about this place. And you can sense that Johnny is feeling the same way about it too. He just sort of looks around and is like, okay, clearly, you know, nothing good happens around here.
Yeah, well, it's an incredibly expressionistic shot where it makes me think of like German expressionism, where it is just this almost exaggerated feeling of space. Even though it's a real space, the way that Cronenberg shoots it and frames it makes it feel almost fantasy-like. And that's incredibly impressive. I also like, and it's not the most complicated shot in the movie, but it's just something that really affected me this time seeing it, is when we see Johnny's vision of the two boys on the lake drowning, and the shots of them, you know, obviously it was done in a tank, of them going down in the water, was just a very, very creepy image to me this time around. And I mentioned that I think Cronenberg has something of a reputation at times for feeling a bit chilly as a director. And obviously with The Dead Zone being set in Maine and it being in the winter, it's always snowing. So that feeling feels very appropriate with this movie. But I don't think that reflects so much in the story or the characters or the acting, but he has a very cold approach. I think about Dodd's suicide scene, which is, you know, cut back and forth with very deliberate precision as to the steps he's taking to kill himself. And it feels very cold and clinical. And that actually makes what he's doing, the specific way he's deciding to kill himself and the aftermath that we see, I think that actually intensifies how horrifying it is.
They have that come across too, without it needing to be super gory or anything like that. And I think that's something that we've seen quite a bit with some of these early movie adaptations from Stephen King. In the book, you will see things one way in your head. And then when you have a director like Cronenberg coming in and sort of just switching up how you see these moments, even if it's not too much, you know, it's like, okay, we get this guy's death. And even though that's not really part of the book necessarily, you've sort of built up an idea of this killer in your head. And you're almost relieved in a sense when it's like, okay, he's clearly out of the picture, even though it happens in such a horrific way. It's not too overdone to where you're like, oh, you know, that was a little too much. Didn't need it to be that gory. It's just gory enough.
Yeah, well, it's not relishing in the moment from like a gleeful, like, ooh, we get to do this really fun gore gag way. And Cronenberg's never been that guy. He always is like, if I'm going to do something violent, I want it to be purposely affecting. And the entire, I find the buildup of Dodd's suicide more horrifying than what we see of the aftermath, which is an actual, you know, gore gag, whereas him sticking the scissors on the side of the bathtub, and then when he puts his hands behind his head and opens his mouth, and I'm like, that's what he's gonna do?
Yeah.
It's already, the picture is painted for me. And it's incredibly effective. I mean, it's one of the things that the movie kind of became notorious for when it was released, and I think it stands as one of kind of the most effective death scenes in any King adaptation. But yeah, the Dead Zone is a very, how should I say this? It's not what I would call a pretty movie, but it's a very well constructed one from as far as cinematography and all of that is concerned. You know, it doesn't look like it's shot for television or anything. It looks like a feature film with a good director behind it, but it's not showy in a whole lot of ways. And I think that's something that could possibly turn people off of it. They might not think it feels kinetic enough, but I think that approach works for kind of the cold story that's being told about this person and his eventual tragic end.
I like the fact that it's not too overdone. And, you know, sometimes people can get really carried away with cinematography and they start trying to do all of these shots that aren't really necessary. But I think Cronenberg was very particular about how he wanted to present this movie to us and what he wanted to show us in a unique way, like the fire scene or the tunnel scene. And it never feels like you're getting too much at once as far as information goes. It's like, here is what you need to know, and here's how I want you to know it. And that's something that is a testament to, like you said, how great of a director he became even after this movie. And I think that's something that really ties everything together very nicely.
Yeah, I think a very interesting Stephen King double feature in terms of cinematography for this would be with Brian De Palma's Carrie.
Yeah.
Because De Palma is a viciously showy director as far as his shot choices and all the fun, you know, I'm going to do split screen and I'm going to do a split diopter shot here and I'm going to have this giant long tracking shot of the camera seeing where everybody is in the auditorium and where the pig's blood is compared to the Dead Zone, which feels very clinical. But that again, that feels appropriate. They're kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, with Carrie too, you have this high school student. So I feel like the cinematography in that almost displays the hectic everyday life of high school, particularly in Carrie's case. And that is something that, like you said, it works well, but when it doesn't, it's very noticeable. And right. I think the fact that you have such big name directors choosing to do these adaptations of Stephen King's work is a testament to the stories that he's telling too, because if people weren't enjoying his work, it wouldn't attract directors like Cronenberg or De Palma or even Stanley Kubrick, even though there is, you know, Stephen King's issues with that adaptation. But it's one of those things where, you know, it helps when you have these big names. And I think a lot of these big names being involved has a lot to do with why these movies still stand up in 2019. You know, without those people directing them, who knows what kind of Dead Zone movie we would have had, it would possibly be one that we wouldn't even enjoy today. And to be honest, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I was like, oh, okay. You know, this was actually very, very well done.
Yeah, I think the Dead Zone has withstood the test of time as a film. You know, it's not too hard for us to imagine horrible politicians like Greg Stilson in today's times, but but
amazing how Stephen King has a knack for that.
Sure, yeah, he saw it coming. But in regards to the rest of King's filmography and his adaptations, you know, at the time, The Dead Zone was really beloved by critics. I think they saw it as, okay, these aren't just kind of tawdry, heightened horror tales all the time, even though that doesn't necessarily mean a bad movie, you know, like Carrie, for instance. But that, you know, The Dead Zone feels like a moment in the Stephen King filmography of, this is for grown-ups too. Like, you know, this isn't just, you know, and obviously we had The Shining before, but that film's treatment at the time of its release was not what its eventual, you know, reappraisal would have you believe. And I think the performances, the approach to the material being very respectful, being very adult, like saying, yeah, we buy into this idea and we're going to treat it like any other drama, helps the Dead Zone, helps anchor the Dead Zone as something that still, I think, to this day stands out in the world of Stephen King filmography. And considering that the 80s are going to end up being really the prime time of Stephen King film adaptations and kind of the height of his pop culture stardom, I think The Dead Zone is by far one of the essential watches from this era.
I totally agree with you. Are there any final thoughts that you have on the movie, or does that sort of wrap everything up nicely here?
I think I'm pretty good. Other than, I do have to admit, the only time I kind of laughed at Christopher Walken's performance that wasn't intentional is his delivery of, "The ice is gonna break." that's about it. That was the most Christopher Walken he was in the movie, and I kind of chortled a little bit. But otherwise, I stand by my statements about, no, he's very good in the movie, and I think this is a great, great movie.
Yeah, I'm very glad that I enjoyed it as much as I did, because sometimes I'm like, okay, 80s horror movies, they can be hit or miss depending on, like I said, who's directing them and what's really going on and what kind of horror movie it is. And knowing the story already for The Dead Zone and then going into this, I was like, okay, let's see how they do these visions. And they did them in the most practical way possible, which certainly helps. But yeah, definitely pleasantly surprised with this one. But on that note, as always, to our listeners, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.